This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And last week, we interviewed the author of a book which has an amazing title. The title is Am I Dying? And I was jealous because I thought, what a great title, what a great segue into answering a lot of questions about various medical diagnoses. And but this week, we're going to top that because here's another title that's really a winner. I'm jealous. Lies My Doctor Told Me. Great title. Medical Myths That Can Harm Your Health. By today's guest. He's Dr. Ken Berry. He's an MD and a family practitioner down in Tennessee. Dr. Berry has cared for innumerable patients, but meanwhile he's been researching the medical myths and outright lies that doctors tell their patients. So in this book, Has Your Doctor Been Lies My Doctor Told Me, he's going to set the record straight on some common misconceptions. So it's a pleasure having you on the program, Dr. Berry. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Indeed. First of all, what prompted you to write the book?
Well, I've always been a bit of a contrarian and someone who's always, my favorite question since as early as I can remember was, why? Why? And I'm sure that I bored all of my adult relatives with that question as I was growing up, and I'm sure that I annoyed a few attending physicians during my medical training with that question, but I find it, even to this day, to be a very important question when someone issues a blanket statement of any sort. I think the number one question we should all ask is, why? And when you keep asking that question long enough and repetitively enough, you ultimately get to the bottom of why that person thinks their why, and then you get to decide whether you believe in that why or not.
So when you titled the book Lies My Doctor Told Me, are these little white lies like, don't worry, this won't hurt a bit? You know, the first lie that we get told when we're little kids, we hold out our arm, innocently, and then we realize that it was all a little bit of a white lie. Or are these lies that are, you know, kind of systematic in our medical system because they conceal some harsh realities?
Well, actually, there is a chapter called Little White Lies that go into the more trivial and somewhat humorous lies that doctors, nurses, and other healthcare professionals will tell their patients. But the bulk of the book is about much more meaningful lies, mistruths, myths, however you'd like to, whatever vernacular you'd like to use. I chose the word lie intentionally so that it would be a bit provocative and would make people stop and think, both patients and doctors. And so most of the chapters in the book are very important lies that doctors tell their patients. And let me be very clear, this book is not an attack piece on doctors. I am a doctor.
Yep.
What this is an attack piece on is laziness and just an inability to continue to be a student. When a doctor stops learning and gets lackadaisical and complacent, that's dangerous to patients. Doctors are supposed to be lifelong learners and teachers, and when they drop the ball on that, then everything else starts to crumble.
Well, you know, to take a page from our current political scene, you might also term these lies fake health news, because journalists and, clickbait headline writers sometimes are complicit in promulgating outmoded viewpoints, especially about diet, and really have have made it harder to have an intelligent discourse about the facts.
I agree 100%. But the problem is when you see that headline, you know, on USA Today or the New York Times, you also shouldn't get that headline confirmed when you go see your doctor. Your doctor should be deeply and widely enough read to say, I know you saw the headline, I saw it too, but here's the actual truth of the matter. Mm-hmm. But what I found in many of my patients who would come to me from another doctor is that they'd been told this clickbaity title as truth, not only by the media, but also by their own personal doctor.
Well, you know, let's start with diet, and you have some iconoclastic views about diet, which I personally share to a large extent. And let's start with one that's kind of embedded way into the book, which is eating red meat causes cancer. What about that?
Sure. Yeah. And so, you know, during my early career as a physician, I believed this to be true. I was told this by all my professors and all my clinical instructors. I just took it to be common sense. We all know this is true. But then a few years back when I actually started looking into the literature that supposedly backed this statement up, it's either non-existent or completely meaningless in terms of trying to apply that research to an individual patient. All of that research is epidemiological in nature, based on food frequency questionnaires, mm-hmm. which I'm sure you're well aware if I do a huge study with hundreds of thousands of patients in it, and I administer a food frequency questionnaire once back in 1985, and then in 2017, I publish a study and say, oh, look at what I found. I mean, is your diet the same as it was in 1985? Because mine certainly isn't. Mm-hmm. And so all of this research is just meaningless when a doctor, somebody who's actually practicing medicine with their cohort of patients, it's just meaningless.
Plus, there's confounding variables. Correlation isn't necessarily causation.
Yes.
And so the average vegan may be more affluent, less likely to live in a polluted area, maybe
yes.
more likely to do yoga than an omnivorous person, although you and I probably eat a lot of red meat and, you know, our health, the rest of our health portfolio is probably pretty up there.
Yeah, we call that the healthy patient bias or the healthy subject bias. Someone who is a vegan or vegetarian, on average, does not smoke, does not drink much, is very active and tries in every way they can to optimize their health. And the average omnivore, on which most of these studies are done, they don't care about any of that stuff. They just want to, you know, eat their Big Mac with the supersized fries and drink mm-hmm. a large Diet Coke because that'll cancel out the rest of the meal. And that's the average person that these studies are done on. Mm-hmm. And then, so you can't even apply that with regards to someone eating a healthy ketogenic diet or a healthy carnivore diet or even someone eating a healthy vegan diet because we're all trying to be as healthy as we possibly can.
Right. Well, this being the grilling season, I got my grass-fed filet mignons, and it's really worthwhile coming out to visit me because I serve great food. And put them on the grill at a high temperature, got a little bit of char on both sides. Was happy to see as I cut into the meat that it was still, you know, pinkish red, not rare, not still mooing. But you know, one of the misconceptions that you tackle here, on page 206, grilling meat causes cancer. That's a really prevailing viewpoint, isn't it?
Absolutely. And again, it's based on the epidemiological research that was popularized by the ARIC, which is a wing of the World Health Organization. And I think all those people are well-intentioned, just like your doctor who will also repeat that lie to you. They all mean the best for you, and they're trying to do a good job. But everything about the research is tainted. There's researcher bias, there's healthy subject bias in this epidemiological research, and what you wind up with is a huge study that really you can't even draw association from, and definitely you can't draw any kind of causation from.
But surely there are things like PAHs, aryl hydrocarbons, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, that have actually been shown to have carcinogenic potential. So Is there a way to offset that potential risk by, say, serving other healthier foods along with the grilled meal?
You'll also find those same chemicals in toast and any, you know, the crust of bread that's been browned in the oven. And so you can't really blame that on the meat. Perhaps you could blame it on the method of cooking. But then secondly, I think another very sexy term we've all been throwing around lately, hormesis. We're all very happy to talk about the sulforaphane in broccoli and how that has a hormetic effect. But in my opinion, for the large bulk of humanity's existence on this planet, we've eaten meat that we've stabbed with a stick and held over the fire. And I don't know if you've ever tried to do that. But it's hard to do that without getting some char. And so if anything, I would posit that these things have a hormetic effect in our body. And if you take some cells in vitro completely out of the body and you slather them in all these chemicals, then you may have some precancerous changes in those cells.
In vitro model.
That's the test tube model
will show that there's a potential for them to alter the cells. But in vivo, in a real-life setting, it's really hard to demonstrate that that's a problem.
Yeah, it's impossible to demonstrate, actually. We have no meaningful research whatsoever that shows that any increased risk of cancer occurs in people who have a healthy carnivore or meat-heavy diet. There's just no research that shows that. And so, once again, we come back to this basically being eminence-based medicine. These very respected individuals at the World Health Organization have this opinion.
It's eminence-based medicine. You just change one letter, and it's eminence.
That's right.
Right. Okay. Got it. Okay, folks, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors to share this vital message with you. Here goes. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as a listener of Intelligent Medicine, you can try a bottle of their finest artisanal olive oil, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. I've been enjoying these harvest fresh olive oils for years. They are far and away the brightest, most lively, and flavorful olive oils I've ever tasted. Their antioxidants and polyphenols are off the charts because they're fresh from the harvest. They make store-bought olive oils taste dull and flat by comparison. Taste for yourself. Check out this generous trial offer and get your $39 bottle for a buck with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you. And now back to Dr. Ken Berry, author of Lies My Doctor Told Me. You weigh in against the medical myth that we all need to curtail our sodium consumption. But that's such a prevailing notion within medicine. I mean, you're really bucking the tide there. Doctors say, you know, skip the salt, restrict your sodium to less than 2 grams per day. What say you?
The American Heart Association has their own diet. They call the DASH diet. And the kind of the foundation of that diet is that you're going to eat a very, very low sodium diet. And I think they fully believe in their heart of hearts that that will decrease your risk of heart attack and heart failure. But the problem is that the controlled research shows the exact opposite. Even in people with stage 2 or 3 heart failure, their heart failure gets worse when you limit their sodium or their salt intake. And so they're definitely on a, if you do a study with 150,000 people and you severely limit their sodium, their systolic blood pressure reading will be 2 or 3 points lower on average. But in the big picture, that's meaningless. That, you know, you can look at an epidemiological landscape where, oh, that prevented 3 heart attacks out of 100,000 people, for example. But on a case-by-case basis, when I'm talking to a patient in the room, everybody feels worse on a low-sodium diet. Everybody hates a low-sodium diet. And the control research that's been done on this, not only in people with normal ejection fractions and normal heart function, but even people who have damaged hearts, they actually have better outcomes, and they have a decrease in morbidity and mortality when they eat more salt. And it looks like humans are hardwired to desire just as much salt as we need, which for most people is 3 to 5 grams mm-hmm. a day of salt. And when you eat that much salt, your heart works very well. You feel great. You're mentally alert. And then even in people with substantial degrees of heart failure, their ejection fractions actually do better when they eat salt to taste. And I think that's what animals do. And I think that's what humans should do as well.
Yeah, there seems to be a paradoxical effect of restricting sodium because it causes some of these counter-regulatory hormones to kick up a notch and thus constrict the blood vessels and maybe also keep fluid within the body.
And absolutely. If you lower the systolic blood pressure 3 points, but in the process of doing that, you raise a person's cortisol and insulin levels, you haven't helped that patient at all, because what we're all concerned about is not lowering our blood pressure 3 points. What we're concerned about is prolonging both our lifespan and our health span. That's what we ultimately care about. I don't want to die. Not only do I not want to die of a heart attack, I don't want to die of anything. And the research shows that when you eat salt to taste, your risk of dying from anything is actually at its lowest.
Yeah, and that's the problem with a lot of these studies, Dr. Perry, is recently they came out with headlines saying chicken is actually just as bad for you as red meat. Well, I come from the same perspective that you do, that red meat is not all that bad for you. And what they did is they looked at what are called surrogate endpoints. And you make a good point, sure. is when you're looking at something like LDL cholesterol or some marker that you can get in a blood test, that doesn't necessarily speak to the longevity of the person who is undertaking this little experiment, either eating chicken or eating red meat or being a vegan. That's what our real concern is, right?
Yeah, and their study found that eating chicken raises your total cholesterol just as much as eating red meat. And to both of those things, I would say, and so what? Because I'm sure are well aware that there's a huge paradigm shift going on in medicine and lipidology research right now. And that's basically that everyone is stepping away from total cholesterol and even LDL cholesterol as a proven risk factor for increased risk of heart attack and stroke. It's going to turn out that probably 20 years from now, I predict that in the first or second year of medical school, medical students will be taught the lipid hypothesis of heart disease as a way that medicine can go awry and the way that researchers can get it wrong, and then how big pharma, basically the big corporations, can come in and make billions off of it, but you've been practicing bad medicine all along. And I think we'll see that in coming years. Med students are taught this is the way you don't do it. And so I'm not worried about total cholesterol at all in my patients. I think, if anything, it's actually a marker of decreased risk of dementia and other things.
And then there's the demonization of fat, particularly saturated fat. And you know, you still see blanket recommendations to reduce the saturated fat, make sure that you get your fat from other sources,
right.
Especially polyunsaturated fat. That's the right kind of fat as opposed to the saturated fat, the bad kind.
Right. And that's just the echo of the lie that doctors don't need to be repeating. Yeah, they said that on Fox News or CNN last night, but that doesn't mean that a doctor should just say, okay, I'm just going to tell all my patients that. And that's why I chose the word lie instead of myth, is because it's our fiduciary duty to give our patients good advice. And that includes nutrition. And if you're telling your patients, oh, you should really cut down on the saturated fat, the patient's next question should be, why? And let the doctor answer that question, because most doctors at that point will say, well, it is known, or everybody knows, or in any time a doctor or any kind of professional says, well, everybody knows, or that's the way we've always done it, that's a huge red flag that the patient's in danger.
And one of the cherished concepts within the nutrition community is that people should consume lots of whole grains. And number 6 among your lies, my doctor told me, is wheat isn't all it's cracked up to be, but it's thought to be, you know, the staff of life, a source of fiber, you know, very beneficial. We can't live without it. What's the deal?
Yeah, emperors and army generals discovered thousands of years ago that if you don't want your troops to starve to death, feed them wheat. It's very cheap. It's easy to get. It lasts a long time, and they won't die. And basically, that's what you want from the masses. You want them to have a full belly and to not be complaining and to not be starving to death. And wheat fills the bill on all those things. But when it comes to optimal human health and optimal human nutrition, wheat falls far short of the bar. Human beings, for the vast majority of our existence on Earth, have eaten as much fatty meat as we can get our hands on. We'll eat some green veg if we can't find the meat. But at no point in our existence, and even other mammals, even the ruminant animals, won't eat grains unless human beings make them to make them.
Corn, they just don't corn-fed cattle, exactly. For example, and hogs.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of an efficient way to stuff an animal with a lot of mm-hmm. calories so that that animal will be more valuable when it goes to the slaughterhouse.
Absolutely. You can make a goose have fatty liver. You can make cattle have fatty muscle, which is that marbling in the ribeye that you and I both love. But you can also use grains, both wheat, corn, and the other grains, to give humans fatty liver and to give humans marbled meat, which is not a good thing at all.
I was a little surprised that you took on another cherished myth, which is the fiber myth. You know, we're very fiber obsessed in this society. You know, we want to make sure that we get 60, 70, 80 grams of fiber every day because fiber is a panacea supposedly for reducing our cholesterol and keeping our colon cancer free and on it goes. But you actually challenged that as somewhat of a misstatement.
Absolutely. When you look at the meaningful research, fiber really serves no purpose whatsoever in the human body. There are so many patients and doctors out there who think you need multiple servings of fiber every day of your
people
life.
People take Metamucil and psyllium.
Yeah, to be able to have a bowel movement. And then also we believe it's going to decrease your risk of colon cancer and other things. But the research that people cite to back that up is just atrocious. Mm-hmm. It's terrible research. And then you also have to take into account that there's a large sub-community of carnivore humans. And I think there's a Facebook group with about 25 or 30,000 carnivores who eat only animal products. And they've done that for decades. And no one has colon cancer. Everyone has normal bowel movements. They have no problem with their bowels. And so then you go back and you look at the research with fresh eyes because these carnivores, they should have scurvy and they should all be constipated to death, right? But they're not. They're all very active. They feel great. Their bowels move great. So then we got to go back and look at the research again and go, wait a minute, we're missing something here. And so probably if you're eating the standard American diet or what I call the stupid American diet, you may need lots of vitamin C and you may need lots of fiber to help you get rid of all the poisonous things that you're eating in your diet. But when you remove those slow poisons from your diet, you don't need nearly as much vitamin C and you don't need any fiber whatsoever.
Wow. Well, I think certainly some of these carnivores are consuming low starch vegetables, maybe modest amounts of fruit. They do deliver nutrients that sometimes meat does not contain, correct?
Well, no, actually, no, I don't agree with that. There's actually no vitamin or mineral that you can't get from animal products if you eat nose to tail like I'm doing more these days.
That's an important distinction because I think a lot of people think that carnivores just eat 22-ounce porterhouse steaks. Explain how that might be, that the nutrients lie within different animal parts, sort of the way our ancestors ate, because, you know, Native Americans, for example, they ate the whole buffalo, nose to tail. So did, the cavemen who tackled woolly mammoths, for example.
So if your carnivore diet consists only of quarter pound patties of beef from McWendy King's, then you may well develop some vitamin deficiencies after a few months of that. But most intelligent carnivores that I know, we eat liver two or three times a week. Mm-hmm. We try to
which supplies folate, which is something we look to in vegetables.
Right. Yeah. Folate, choline, and most liver has a good supply of vitamin C. And it looks like when you're eating a very low carbohydrate diet, as a carnivore diet would be by definition, you just don't need as much vitamin C because you don't have as much unhealthy oxidation going on in your body. Therefore, you don't need all of that antioxidant effect from the mega doses of vitamin C. But liver is rich in choline and folate and all these other things that you have trouble getting from a plant-based diet. And then it doesn't actually show it. If you go to the USDA website and ask how much vitamin C is in a ribeye, it'll say zero.
Right.
Actually, not true at all. All fresh meat has a little vitamin C. Mm-hmm. And then organ meats are rich in vitamin C.
Hmm. Interesting. That's a factoid I was not aware of. But, you know, it does argue for the paleo approach, sort of emulating the lifestyles for which our genes were evolved to address.
Absolutely. Our genes have been evolving on this planet for millions of years. We have been Homo sapiens sapien for at least 250,000 years on this planet. And so you can't say, oh, well, we've done something for 100 years or even 500 or 1,000 years. That's not even 1% of our existence on this planet. Our DNA has existed as Homo sapiens sapien for 200 to 250,000 years. That's a long damn time. And so then all of a sudden when big food starts throwing these Franken foods at us, like industrial
the
seed oils.
Burger, something like that.
Right, exactly. And so if anybody thinks, oh, well, that's probably the perfect food for human beings, then you just bought the lie.
Yeah. All right. Well, you've laid it out very eloquently on the diet front. The book is Lies My Doctor Told Me, Medical Myths That Can Harm Your Health. And when we return, we divide our podcast into two parts. So when we return, we're going to talk a little bit about other medical white lies, or more than that, sometimes a conspiracy of silence or an effort to deliberately mislead us. So that's really where this book is headed. Dr. Ken Berry, our guest. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.